irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can get on with your life, get to a healthy way of relating to food, and get on with your life, because wouldn't it be so much better to wake up and think about your day, not your diet? It's all about what's eating at you, not actually what you're eating. So if you're just tuning in right now and you're listening on the 5th, of June. This is a pre-recorded show. I am not there. I am here on a Sunday pre-recording the show. So if you have any questions, please wait until the next week to call in, and I would be happy to talk to you about what is weighing on you, what is eating at you, what is on your mind. Today, I am going to be reading from a chapter of my new book, Beyond the Primal Addiction. This is a book that I co-edited with my mentor and great friend, Salman Akhtar, Dr. Salman Akhtar, the great Dr. Salman Akhtar. It's called Beyond the Primal Addiction, Food, Sex, Gambling, Internet, Shopping, and Work. And so I'm often asked about my scholarly books, like, do you have an audio version of the book? No, I do not. So I decided to make an audio version today. So today is probably part one of the audio version of my chapter on food addiction, chapter two of Beyond the Primal Addiction. So let's just get to it. Food addiction. People who, oh wait, I by the way, I do have a little guest here in the studio, and she's looking like she wants to say something.
Hi.
What was that?
Hi.
So I have to say, I'm here on a Sunday pre-recording the show, and I'm here with my daughter, who is keeping me company, taking some pictures. Hi, Kavana. Okay. Bye, Kavana.
Bye.
I'm going to mute you now. All right. So everyone, that was my 11-year-old daughter. She's pretty amazing. Okay, here we go. Food addiction. People who binge or relentlessly overeat often believe that food is the problem. They describe themselves as chocoholics or foodaholics. They fear they'll always struggle with what they call an addiction to food. Many report they never consume sugar or white flour. They think the only way to stay clean, as they put it, is to avoid all problematic or forbidden foods. Inevitably, they binge or overeat, experiencing intense feelings of shame and labeling themselves as hopeless addicts. Yet, is food addiction a valid concept? In the last few years, there's been a great deal of media coverage about this. Last year, I posted in a public Facebook group that with respect to binge eating, psychological triggers are far more influential than the food itself. Now, one reader took offense, writing that it was a, quote, proven fact, unquote, that sugar is as addictive as heroin. This person is not alone in her hyperbolic assertion that heroin and sugar are equivalent. Lately, it seems that the notion of food addiction, especially sugar addiction, is accepted by the general public as scientifically factual, as is the idea of detoxing from sugar. This notion of detoxification is also false, since any food eaten, even pure protein sources, can be turned into sugar in the body through the process of gluconeogenesis. Gosh, I just love saying that. Gluconeogenesis. That is a metabolic pathway that results in glucose being generated from non-carbohydrate foods. Now, the premise of a recent bestseller, Gary Taubes, is that sugar is not only addictive, but is the principal cause of obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, and many other fatal diseases. This book and others assert that sugar is poisoning us, making us obese and unhealthy. Studies from the fields of neurology and obesity research have come to divergent conclusions. Some researchers believe that food may be considered addictive, and these studies make a case for the reward theory of food addiction, correlating specific foods with increased dopamine levels. Dopamine is the chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation in our brains. So the basic theory of food addiction is that sugar and other foods activate the release of dopamine. People eat sugar, get a dopamine rush, feel good, and then they have to eat increasing amounts to get the same experience they previously felt with less. Food addiction theory points to these changes in the brain, specifically higher levels of dopamine, as evidence of addiction. A plethora of other studies, however, refute these claims. Many of them actually deduce there is little evidence to support the idea of any food as physiologically addictive, including sugar, which is the substance most often labeled as addictive. Nutrition researcher and neurobiologist Stefan, apologies if I'm butchering your name, Guiné, perhaps, reminds us that diet and lifestyle factors such as excessive calorie intake, physical inactivity, cigarette smoking, alcohol, and illegal drug use contribute to obesity and other non-communicable diseases. He further notes that these diseases are not at all correlated with sugar intake and points out, this is the interesting part, points out that sugar intake has actually been declining in the past two decades, the same period in which both obesity and diabetes rates have dramatically increased. So sugar does change our brains, as do certain drugs. Guess what? Spending time with friends, playing games, having sex, shopping, any other pleasurable activity also raises the dopamine levels in our brains. One study proved that listening to classical music has the same impact on our brains as cocaine. Our brains also react differently to sugar than to drugs like cocaine or heroin. In research studies with rodents who were given cocaine, their dopamine levels surged but did not return to baseline. That's why the rodents needed more and more of the drug to maintain the baseline dopamine levels. That's not what happens with sugar or any other so-called addictive foods with humans. After ingesting sugar, dopamine levels surge, yes they do, but they later return to a baseline level and stay consistent. Also, the studies that confirm that rats show more addictive behavior for sugar than for drugs such as cocaine or heroin are misleading. Humans are motivated by psychology as well as biology, but rats are motivated by survival. Rats do not turn to food to soothe hurt feelings, to numb themselves, to distract themselves from the painful exigencies of life. Rats are primarily food-seeking, and sugar is food. Naturally, they choose sugar over drugs like heroin or cocaine. A researcher in 2009 examined the animal model of sugar addiction and found it baseless, deducing that there is no support for the notion that sugar is addictive. Researcher Margaret Westwater and her colleagues also found little evidence to support sugar addiction in humans. They suggest that addiction-like behaviors, such as binging, occur only in the context of intermittent access to sugar. These behaviors likely arise from intermittent access to sweet-tasting or highly palatable foods, not the neurochemical effects of sugar. She and her team also differentiates between sugar per se, sugar on its own, and sugary foods, which usually contain fat. She makes the point that most people do not eat spoonfuls of sugar, which if you were addicted to sugar, you would expect that people would eat spoonfuls of sugar. Not just to make the medicine go down. I just heard that song in my head from, what, Mary Poppins? Okay, let me start over. She makes the point that most people do not eat spoonfuls of sugar, but rather have food that contains sugar. The researchers also note the difference between cravings for food and drugs. Food cravings are relatively short-lived and subside when you don't have it. as opposed to drug cravings, which persist and do not lessen in intensity with abstinence. Similarly, another study concludes sugar does not seem to contribute to weight gain more so than other sources of energy in the diet. Instead, the current scientific community nowadays seems to reach consensus that food addiction and its quote unquote food addiction, by the way, and its role in weight gain might be better explained by eating dependence as a result of the unique individual experience with food and eating instead of being caused by a specific food. Of course, self-described food addicts do not always identify sugar as their drug of choice. In the same study that refuted sugar as an addictive substance, Marcus and his colleagues identified the types of foods that are most commonly associated with addiction-like behavior. Their research showed that high-fat, savory foods are more likely to trigger addiction-like behavior. In fact, only one person in 20 reported addiction-like behavior for mainly sugar-containing foods. People have cravings for various types of foods, some craving chocolate, others pizza, and they may find it difficult to eat those foods in appropriate quantities, yet that does not constitute a physical addiction. There are other reasons for this inability to stop eating a particular food. There's also a link between dieting and binge eating. When people rely on willpower, telling themselves they cannot or should not eat a particular food, they are more likely to binge on that food later. Sometimes this is because deprivation leads to wanting more of what they cannot have. And sometimes it's as a means of managing anticipated future deprivation. Many patients have said something along the lines of, "I'm going to eat this whole pizza because after this, I won't be able to eat pizza for months." Additionally, there's a link between the anticipation of dieting and binge eating, the anticipation of deprivation of specific foods, as well as the actual deprivation experienced through restriction or dieting, therefore leads to overeating or binge eating. This highlights the importance of unconscious psychological motivations with regard to binging. So what does this look like in real life? Let's talk about Ruth, who considered herself a food addict. She felt discouraged by her lack of control over food at night. Single, never married, and relatively new to the Los Angeles area, she had not formed any meaningful friendships, nor was she dating, believing that nobody would be attracted to her at her current weight. Ruth easily made healthy choices at breakfast and lunch. Only in the evening, when she was by herself, did food become a problem. She described how in those dark hours, an emptiness came upon her, slowly expanding until it was an unbearable void. When we explored that internal void, she spoke of a childhood marked by desperate loneliness, and I had the sense of her being enveloped by forlornness. But Ruth was not interested in talking about the past, talking about her childhood. From her perspective, the problem was in the here and now. I suggested it was not a matter of willpower or control. I believe that her relationship to food was expressing something that her mind could not process or tolerate. When she was alone at night, she felt the echoes of that childhood loneliness and emptiness. By stuffing herself until she was full, she symbolically filled that emotional void with food, unconsciously swapping emotional emptiness for a full stomach. Instead of feeling emotionally uncomfortable, she experienced only the physical sensation of discomfort. Ruth had been focused on what she was eating instead of identifying and processing what was eating at her. The problem was not food, but rather her intense emotional hunger. Ruth looked dazed at this notion. She said, "So, I'm not a food addict?" She considered this and sighed in relief. "All this time, I thought there was something wrong with my brain that made me eat," she said. We are in the middle of a cultural zeitgeist that increasingly privileges biology over psychology, and this extends to research in binge eating. One recent study in 2016 with Kessler, with a K, found that binge eating disorder may be related to maladaption of the corticostriatal circuitry regulating motivation and impulse control, similar to that found in other impulse compulsive disorders. Say what? I believe this view of disordered eating as a brain-based illness is myopic. Yes, we have brains, the organ that is the physical control structure of our body. But we also have minds, which refers to a range of mental processes. Our minds allow us to think, feel, imagine, believe, remember, and perceive on both a conscious and unconscious level. Our brains do not operate alone, nor do our minds function independently of our brains. Research that focuses excessively on the brain as the primary source of behavior ignores the powerful influence of the unconscious mind, as well as the familial, social, cultural, and other influences that impact our brains. People turn to food for a reason, for comfort, to alleviate anxiety, to distract from painful or upsetting thoughts, to sleep, to symbolically fill a void, to calm down. Eating is a way of managing difficult internal states. It is the mind's way of protecting itself. Another reader who responded to my Facebook post about the importance of psychological motives relating to binge eating shared that she had initially joined the sugar is like heroin message. She believed that sugar is like heroin message, which she believed actually caused her to binge on sugar, further reinforcing the idea that she was an addict. Then she noticed that her children had no problem eating sugar, she said, sometimes in small amounts, sometimes larger, and sometimes they couldn't care less about it. And I realized I was the exact same way when I didn't try to restrict it, she wrote. She says she cautiously began allowing herself to have sugar, and it had not been a problem ever since. She said she finally feels empowered around it instead of a scared victim. She further noted that when she started allowing herself pleasurable activities through the day, when she started having fun, then bingo, sugar wasn't a thought. Because you know what? If you're not having enough fun in your life, you are vulnerable to using sugar or foods with sugary foods for fun. So this absolutely aligns with my clinical experience treating people who struggle with binge eating. Most enter treatment believing themselves to be sugar addicts, unable to keep cookies, candy, ice cream, or anything with sugar in the house, lest they consume it all. They say, I can't have cookies in the house. Are you crazy? All I'll do is think about those cookies. My mind will be on those cookies the whole time, and I won't rest until I've eaten every single one of those cookies, usually in one sitting. And then all I will be thinking about is how I ate those damn cookies. No, I cannot have cookies in the house, or ice cream, or candy, or you have it. By the time they leave therapy, they are able to eat sugary foods in moderation, often without giving it another thought. Their brains have not changed, but their minds have undergone a structural transformation. Of course, the science makes little difference to patients who experience intense powerlessness and helplessness over their eating and when they are preoccupied with food, often to the point of obsession. They eliminate what they consider forbidden foods only to end up binging and feeling terrible. As one patient put it, I may not be addicted to food, but I sure feel like an addict. When it comes to eating issues, food actually serves as a temporary solution to the problem. Only by decoding the symbolism of eating and identifying the underlying conflict or deficit that is leading to the behavior can permanent change be created. From this vantage point, the psychoanalytic perspective can be helpful and transformative. So specifically with respect to food, the notion of addiction, give you an overview. The first notion of addiction from a psychoanalytic perspective was back in 1925 when an analyst observed that gratification in the form of overeating is always followed by some sort of physical pain, implying that binging implicitly provides the pleasure of indulgence and simultaneously gives the pain of self-punishment. That was back in 1925. 1945 was when Otto Fenichel was the first psychoanalytic writer to use the term food addiction. And he said it manifests for various reasons. And other people, I think I'm not going to go through the history of this. Let's just go the more contemporary view. So most self-reported addicts believe they lack willpower and are biochemically addicted to food, which is what I was just talking about. In reality, they are often struggling with a diagnosable condition known as binge eating disorder. Binge eating disorder is the most common type of eating disorder. The most common type of eating disorder, impacting an estimated 8 million people in the United States alone and many more worldwide. And by the way, it's much, much higher, because that's basically self-reported people. There are many people who don't even think or would never even entertain the notion that they have an eating disorder. They just think they have no control. Many people who fit the diagnostic criteria for binge eating have no idea that their eating issues represent a symptom of an underlying disorder. Physically, binge eating disorder patients may or may not be overweight, as the presence of obesity is not in itself an indication of binge eating disorder. People become overweight or obese for various factors, including poor eating habits and heredity. They may not have the knowledge, ability, or financial resources to prepare nutritious food, or may not get enough exercise. So these factors contribute to obesity, but are not indications of an eating disorder. Psychologically, despite differences in gender, age, ethnicity, socioeconomic levels, I find that all the patients I have treated for binge eating disorder and all the clients in my online programs have deficits in self-soothing. That is the one commonality I see almost always. So from the earliest moments of life, the way we are spoken to, responded to, cared for, and touched form the basis of our relationships to ourself. Drawing from Donald Winnicott's conception of the good enough mother, when we have parents who are attuned to us, who try to understand our thoughts and emotions, and withstand and tolerate our anger, we internalize those parental objects, sort of psychoanalytic speak. I wish there was a different term. I should come up with a different term. Sort of those parental objects, meaning the symbols of our parents. We identify with them, and we develop a way of relating to ourselves that is optimally responsive when everything goes well. In the absence of the ability to identify with or internalize a loving, soothing presence, some people turn to the symbolic representation of comfort, namely food. Back in 1946, an analyst wrote, "The first relief from physical discomfort the child experiences is nursing, and thus the satisfaction of hunger becomes deeply associated with the feeling of well-being and security." In this way, food registers in our psyches as symbolic representation of this soothing relationship between a parent and a baby. And notably, we use the same language to describe both food and relationships. We describe each as satisfying and fulfilling. Our cultural vernacular includes references that connect food to relationship, such as being hungry for love, starving for attention. When people are unpredictable, unavailable, or unreliable, human connections and relationships can feel too dangerous. Yet food is always predictable, available, and reliable. From a self-psychological perspective, that's a type of psychoanalysis, compulsive eating is, quote, an attempt to replace that object with food, and with the activity of eating. So what they're saying is that disappointment in interactions with people cause some patients to turn away from human relationships and turn to food as a primary means of comfort. In this way, hunger for food essentially replaces hunger for love and connection. In 1951, a psychoanalyst researcher named, I kid you not, Hamburger. Yes, that is his name. Hamburger wrote a paper titled Emotional Aspects of Obesity, and he presents four types of female patients who used food for the purpose of self-soothing. He studied 18 people. He had 18 participants in a study, and all had a history of some type of disturbed relationship in their families during their formative years. So the four types: one group overeat to relieve non-specific emotional tensions, a second group who use food as an automatic response to the tensions and frustrations of life. For a third group, overeating functions as a symptom of something, some underlying conflict or depression. And a fourth group, he said, was an addiction to food, because that fourth group reported uncontrollable cravings for food. But further investigation with this fourth group revealed that those patients in the fourth group all used food as a substitute for love, affection, and security. Turning to food for relief can be so automatic that many people don't even realize they're experiencing an emotional trigger or conflict. The experience of binging, the action of binging, distracts them from recognizing what they're feeling, thinking, needing, or wanting. Compulsive eating can create sort of a dissociative, trance-like state that protects from painful or upsetting feelings. I've had many patients who say, oh, I was in the binge zone. I was in the binge zone. Dissociation is considered as serving people who binge eat to just protect themselves from life, from anything uncomfortable. And again, this fits the description I hear from patients who say they're in a food fog. They're in the zone. They report an absence of thought and emotion during episodes of compulsive eating. The world fades away, leaving only food and the act of eating and a temporary sense of safety and protection from what in life is or seems intolerable. So what does this look like in real life? My example is Hannah. She sought treatment for, yes, she called it food addiction, because she was 30 years old, 30 pounds overweight, and miserable. She was single, employed in an upper management position at a national real estate firm, yet she felt like a failure because she just could not control her weight. She went on her first diet in early adolescence after a gymnastics coach suggested she lose a few pounds, a comment she found deeply shaming. And she had been dieting ever since, her entire adult life. Food was all Hannah thought about from the second she woke up until the minute her head hit the pillow. At breakfast, she was thinking about lunch. At lunch, she was thinking about dinner. At night, she was worried about what she would eat the next day. Hannah began one session by informing me that she could prove she was a food addict, that there was nothing emotional or conflictual creating her binges. So the previous night, she'd been watching television after work when suddenly, as she put it, Ben and Jerry's was calling my name. Calling my name, she repeated with emphasis. She told me that nothing was wrong, nothing was bothering her, and that her day had been perfectly fine and free of conflict. Since she was not eating for emotional reasons, she must be addicted to Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I asked her what she'd been watching on TV right before Ben and Jerry's started calling her name. It turned out to be a show called Charmed. This was her favorite TV program, and she was always happy when she got a chance to relax and watch the show. To Hannah, this was further proof that she was a food addict. She was happy to be relaxing and watching Charmed, so there was no reason other than addiction to explain her sudden craving for ice cream. When I asked for details about the episode she was watching, She said, oh, it's the one where the devil comes down and the sisters start fighting and everything gets really nasty. And she stopped. Her voice trailed because at that moment, Hannah realized watching the episode of Charmed had activated painful thoughts and emotions about her own sister with whom she had a contentious, nasty relationship. Yet before those thoughts and feelings could reach her conscious awareness, she turned to Ben and Jerry's for comfort and distraction. Hannah was not turning to ice cream because her brain had formed a physical addiction. She craved Ben and Jerry's ice cream because her mind was looking for a way to escape the anger she felt towards her sister and the hurt. If we had focused on her addiction to ice cream, we would have completely missed her conflict over feeling angry towards her sister and her resistance. Also, we would have missed her resistance to consciously recognizing that anger, along with a concurrent need for punishment for simply having those feelings. She felt guilty over these feelings of hatred towards her sister. And then she displaced her guilt into eating ice cream. By exploring the underlying hatred and normalizing her emotional responses and conflicts about her relationship with her sister, Hannah was able to make peace with food instead of using it as a way to dissociate from her experience. And by the way, sometimes only by allowing yourself to recognize your hateful feelings can they diminish so that you can then, instead of fighting your hatred, you don't feel it. But first you got to feel it so you don't feel it. It sounds counterintuitive, but the only way to get rid of feelings is to feel them. Okay, so psychoanalysis actually evolved from Freud's interest in understanding why in some circumstances there's this mysterious leap from mind to body. Many of his patients suffered from what was then called hysteria, which was considered a bodily issue until he created the talking cure, which suggested that some kind of conversion was taking place, a shift from the psychological to the physical. Donald Winnicott coined the term the psyche soma, psyche and meaning body, and psyche meaning mind, and soma meaning body. That proposes the idea that mind and body are not separate, but interrelated. The psyche refers to the mental structure of an individual, and the soma refers to his or her physical body. When things go well in early development, infants develop a healthy sense of self and their minds and bodies are felt to be one. When things do not go well, meaning that feeding leads to the internalization, the psyche and soma are not experienced as connected, leading to a mind-body split. And when there is no unified self to provide support, comfort, and relief with words, people may turn to their body as a way of expressing their conflicts, needs, wants, and emotions. So somatization is the conversion of mental conflict into physical symptoms. And the notion of the body as a means of communication can be helpful when you understand people who eat to the point of pain or whose physical bodies express some kind of fear or intention. Some people believe their size protects them from being the recipient of sexual interest by others. Others feel more powerful because they are bigger, meaning they need to take up more space in order to feel visible and viable. Being little is connected with being weak, and being big feels powerful. There are many, 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 many reasons embedded in the language of the body and the size of the body, which has to be then understood and articulated verbally instead of somatically. But many people with eating issues have a great deal of difficulty experiencing anything emotionally painful or depressing. Often, they don't want to feel it. And of course, who wants to feel pain, anguish, and depression? So When you can't allow yourself to trust in the basic experience of need and dependency, you turn to food when you're upset, which again is a symbolic representation of nurturing. Also, many people have a hard time identifying and expressing emotional states. People who use food to numb and escape what's going on inside mean they often have a hard time recognizing and processing emotions, and therefore they can't express them. And then their bodies express them. I remember one patient used to tell me, "I feel water coming into my eyes," rather than saying she was upset and she was crying. "I feel water coming into my eyes," right? Just so distanced from her own body. One of the first psychoanalysts to write about eating disorders, Hilda Bruch, again, I'm just terrible with these names. I should know how to pronounce her name. Bruch. She notes that when it comes to the state of hunger, it is important to distinguish between the psychological state of awareness that the body needs nutrition and other meanings, such as the understanding of hunger as a symbolic expression of a state of need in general, or as a simile for want in other areas. If hunger is a means of representing a state of emotional yearning, as in the common expression, hungry for love, starving for attention, then binging on food and overeating can be understood as an unconscious way of expressing the longing for a relational experience. When you don't have the access to language to describe what's going on internally, you communicate by other means. Your body thinks out loud the feelings the mind cannot. Okay, so what does this look like? Let's talk about Marta, who sought treatment because nearly every night she ate a family-sized bag of potato chips. She felt completely out of control when it came to potato chips. Yet after a few weeks, she reported she was not eating chips every night. She was a model patient. She showed up on time or early to every session. She worked hard to make sense of the concepts we discussed. She read about psychoanalytic principles. She diligently tracked her dreams, her emotions, her thoughts, her interactions with others. Several months into the treatment, I went on vacation for a week. Upon my return, Marta shared she had been upset with me for leaving. She immediately reassured me that she was not actually angry with me, and it was just the transference talking. Marta reminded me of a student trying to please a teacher instead of a patient undergoing analysis. Now, her parents had been authoritarian and inflexible, insisting they knew what was best for their children and demanding compliance rather than showing interest in their children's emotions and thoughts. Marta learned that acquiescence was the key to relational harmony. Only by perceiving what her parents wanted and then submitting could she assure herself of their acceptance. Unbeknownst to herself, Marta was repeating this dynamic with me. It seemed she was trying to please me instead of using our sessions to better understand herself. She did not put herself in a position of vulnerability. Outwardly, she appeared to depend on me, but actually, she was doing all the thinking and interpreting herself, excluding me in the process. She reported on her insights instead of talking about her feelings. She began to drop weight, losing a total of 80 pounds in just over 6 months. She considered this a miracle and attributed her success to me. "You're amazing, Dr. Nina," she explained. "Nobody else has been able to help me until now. I am so glad I found you." I felt increasingly uneasy with this idealization, as well as with her notable weight loss. When I was suggesting that she was relating to me as she had her parents and losing weight to please me, she quickly disagreed. "You're nothing like them," she assured me. I interpreted that her relentlessly positive attitude towards me might be hiding other emotions. I normalized anger, hostility, jealousy, anything else. I invited Marta to share her feelings, but she resisted the notion that her favorable feelings towards me represented idealization. She steadfastly held the position that her positive feelings towards me were simply that, positive feelings. She pointed out, Even Freud said sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Shortly after she reached her goal weight, Marta began to binge again. At each session, she appeared to be visibly bigger, gaining weight in front of my eyes. She was no longer eating potato chips, but instead was, quote unquote, really into chocolate. I began feeling a palpable sense of helplessness, watching her gain weight at such a rapid pace. Marta bemoaned her loss of control, castigating herself and blaming herself. I'm just a hopeless case, she told me. I'm hopeless. Her words were self-deprecating, her manner sorrowful, yet I found myself wanting to shake Marta for gaining weight, for rejecting our work together. I was frustrated with her for resisting the development of any true connection between us. I believed that Marta's ballooning weight was expressing what her mind could not. She was angry with me, since I represented an authority figure to her, and she was also rebelling against my perceived authority over her. An overly obedient child, she had never rebelled or differentiated herself from her parents. Now, by gaining weight, she was actively rebelling. She was also unconsciously creating in me the feelings of helplessness and anger that marked nearly every day of her childhood. Now I was feeling what she felt as a kid. When Marta complained about the weight gain, I decided to be more transparent about my countertransference. Countertransference is all the feelings that a therapist feels about or towards a patient, and how that can be very helpful for understanding the person in the room that you're in the room with. It's a gift, actually. I told Marta that I believed she was letting me know how she had felt as a child, how she had felt submitting to the expectations of her parents, helpless, angry. At the beginning of our work together, she had related to me as she had to her parents, complying with the treatment and essentially losing weight for me. It was as if she did it for me rather than for herself. Now, by gaining weight, leaving me unable to help her, she had effectively reversed roles, making me the helpless, angry, and impotent one. I not only intellectually understood what she had lived through as a child, I now had a visceral sense of her experience. Several minutes of silence followed my interpretation or my thoughts. I had no idea what she was thinking or feeling. And then she left the session without saying another word, leaving me hanging, or so it felt. At the next session, she sat up on the couch instead of lying down and faced me. With slow deliberation, she took a Toblerone chocolate bar out of her purse and unwrapped it. She looked at me as if daring me to react. She placed the chocolate bar on the coffee table between us as if throwing down a gauntlet. I considered it a moment before lifting my gaze to her watchful eyes. That looks yummy, I commented. She looked startled. You really don't care if I eat this or not? You really don't care if I eat this or not? So her question, followed by her rhetorical question, was a first recognition that something had been playing out between us, a dynamic that needed to be better understood. And that actually began a conversation about power and relationships. And with it, a very, very early form of true relating. When Marta was finally able to use words to express her anger at feeling controlled or to talk about her wish to rebel against restrictions, she stopped using food and her body to express those conflicts and wishes. And she lost weight normally. Let me see. I have about 6 minutes. I'm going to start this. I'm going to do these on a regular basis while I get through the whole chapter. So that was eating as an expression of somatic language, body language. So this is eating as an expression of object hunger. A, A child's first object is the mother's breast that nourishes it, said Freud in 1938. Love has its origin in attachment to the satisfied need for nourishment. What does that mean? As infants, our experience of feeding is bound up with a sense of connection, safety, and love. Food serves to represent mother, mothering, and love. And by the way, the term mother is usually connected with the female parent. But for the purposes of this chapter, I want to expand the definition of mother to refer to any primary parent or caregiver, regardless of gender. Binging, with or without the resulting weight gain, may serve as a way of incorporating that mother, as a way of managing separation anxiety. It may be a way of relating to or controlling the mother, the symbol of mother. And also, since it seems that fathers are very much underrepresented in psychoanalytic literature, I also say that this idea of sort of taking in a maternal relationship can also refer to any important person, mother, father, anybody who's significant. If food is unconsciously felt to represent people and relationship, then eating is a way of taking in and keeping these people internally, symbolically, and therefore never being alone. And the idea of what's called oral incorporation is a way of taking in and holding that mother. Like, if food functions again as a symbol of mother and thus of mothering. Symbols are substitutes that represent the original person and are used to overcome loss. So let me quickly start and tell you about Arlene. When she was in her late 30s, she came to treatment, hoping to overcome her donut addiction. Raised in a strict Catholic family, she was the oldest of 8 children, and during her childhood, she was expected to help her mother take care of the younger children. Her siblings were known as the kids, and Arlene always felt her place in the family was as a second-class mother rather than as a daughter or a sibling. Her mother proclaimed that leaning on or depending on anyone else was a sign of weakness, yet she openly relied on Arlene's help for childcare, house cleaning, and more. Arlene found this "do as I say, not as I do" communication highly bewildering. She was not close to her father, who died in a car accident when she was in high school. Prior to his death, he'd been sort of an amorphous figure, a businessman who came home and went straight to his study to relax and unwind. Every weekend, he left early for the golf course and returned home for supper. Arlene and her siblings were cautioned never to bother their father, and they had relatively little interaction with him. Her strongest memory of her father was that he constantly drank root beer, which he referred to as mother's milk. After his death, she longed even more for her mother's unconditional love and acceptance, yet always sensed that she felt short of expectations. She interpreted this as meaning she didn't deserve her mother's love. The family focus was on achievement, and negative emotions, so-called negative emotions, such as anger, sadness, and disappointment, were not tolerated. Her mother became annoyed when anyone was sick. Illness was both an inconvenience and an indication of weakness. If Arlene had a fever and complained, her mother said, "Quit your belly aching." No matter what Arlene did, it was never enough. If she brought home good grades, she was asked why they weren't better. Why had she not done extra credit? She never felt as if she were good enough, and she felt guilty about having any feelings about this lack of acknowledgement or love. She married young and got pregnant. Shortly after she gave birth to her first child, she began having sudden cravings for donuts. She'd buy a baker's dozen of donuts and would sit in her car alone, stuffing donuts into her mouth, unable to stop, often with tears running down her cheeks. She was disgusted by her perceived lack of control. And over the next several years, she would just go on diet after diet. Inevitably, her willpower failed, and she found herself driving to Krispy Kreme. Arlene's identification with her mother was apparent from the beginning of our work, when she shared how ashamed she was for belly aching about things that upset her. Becoming a mother had facilitated in her a deep hunger for mothering, which is why the donut addiction began then. As we worked through this, the symbolism of the donuts became clear. They have a missing piece at the center, representing the missing piece at the center of her mother. She had a mother, but not a mommy. So the sweet, sugary donuts were her way of incorporating both a representation of her mother, complete with a missing piece. By their very design, donuts conveyed the presence of an absence. As the treatment progressed, so did the nature of Arlene's addiction. She developed a thing for cream-filled donuts and bought two at a time, only two at a time. One day she bit into a cream-filled donut and to her dismay realized the cream was missing. She was distraught and couldn't figure out why she was so upset and angry, but felt as if she had somehow been cheated. She returned to the donut shop, but they were out of white cream-filled donuts. They only had chocolate-filled donuts. She didn't want those. She said, "I just wanted the white cream. I just wanted that cream filling," she said, emphatically holding her hands in front of her chest and moving them back and forth. "I really wanted it." I was struck by the way her hands were cupped, as if to form the shape of breasts. I suggested the two cream-filled donuts represented the full breasts of her mother, a version of mother's milk that she could actually take in. This resonated with Arlene, who reflected she had shifted from symbolically focusing on what was not there in the donuts to craving something tangible and filling. Alas, just as there was no cream filling, there was no sweet maternal object to incorporate, no mother to take in. I'm over time. Thank you, Ronan, for letting me, our wonderful engineer, for letting me go a little late. So that is the first part of my reading my food addiction chapter from my book, Beyond the Primal Addiction, which I edited with my amazing co-editor, Salman Akhtar. Tune in next week. I will be here in person, ready to answer your calls. I will be here at LA Talk Radio Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, as I am every time. Have a great couple weeks. I'll see you then. Bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.